After such beautiful music, it's really a shame to have to talk about last year. As we begin the new year, the question on everyone's mind is, when will the recession come and how serious will the recession be? And the fact that this is the question suggests that the answer to the another question, what kind of year was 1978 last year, is not a very auspicious or hopeful one. Incidentally, my favorite cartoon of the year showed a father explaining the facts of economic life to his son. He was trying to explain to him the difference between a recession and a depression. He said, "My son, a recession is when a goodly number of people are out of work. A depression is when I'm out of work." But I want to begin this review of 1978 halfway around the world, and with this day last year. President and Mrs. Carter spent New Year's Eve last year at a royal fancy dress ball in Tehran, given for them by Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, Shah of Iran, and his beautiful wife. The ball was done with imperial magnificence. There was a sense of well-being, self-satisfaction throughout. After all, Iran was receiving the wealth of the world in return for its oil, and America was receiving back some of the wealth of Iran for our advanced weapons systems and for our technology. We were partners, seemingly in common purpose. And the evening went off swimmingly. The president and his wife have often spoken of the affection that they felt and the respect that they felt for the Shah, for his kindness, his self-assurance, his infinite courtesy. Of course, they thought little that night of the secret police of the Shah or of any of the problems that faced Iran. Well, this New Year's Eve, uneasy sits the crown. The Shah, in fact, by tonight may no longer be in Iran. Certainly, he has lost his ability to rule that country. The mobs are in the streets. The oil fields are shut down. The programs to bring Iran into the 20th century are a shambles. There's not even enough gasoline, apparently, to run the cars and to cook with. How much a year can change the fate of a country, the fate of a man? And I suspect that when our president spends this New Year's Eve, not in a Persian palace, but in a peanut farm in Plains, Georgia, he'll think a bit about last year. He'll remind himself of the fate of the crowned head, and I suspect there'll be a silent tear or two for it. He and Mrs. Carter seem genuinely to have been fond of the Shah. But more than that, he'll be beset by a whole series of new problems, he and, of course, our country. For Iran was a major supplier of energy to Western Europe and to Japan. For many years now, we've maintained an important string of radar bases along the 1,400-mile border between Iran and the Soviet Union, part of our early warning system against missile attack, part of our surveillance and informational system to tell us what the Russians are doing. And those who have organized the attack on the Shah, the old National Front, progressive, Nasserite, Ba'athist, leftist forces of Iran, and the Shiite Muslim mullahs, the fervent Muslim nationalists, will certainly move Iran towards neutralism, towards an active role in the pan-Islamic third world attitudes towards Israel and the West. And I'm sure that whatever else happens, we will have to dismantle whatever military positions we have in the country. And of course, there is the long-range question of what this means for the security of Saudi Arabia, the Persian oil states, for the security of those feudal kingdoms on whom we depend for our oil. For during 1948, 78, the United States continued to increase its consumption of foreign oil till nearly half of all the gasoline and oil which we consume in these United States comes to us from abroad. We learned a great deal about what used to be called the domino theory during the war in Southeast Asia, and to a large degree we tended to discount that theory that if we pulled out of Vietnam, other parts of Southeast Asia would go behind the Iron Curtain or the Bamboo Curtain. But in the affairs of men, there is to a certain degree a cause and effect relationship between all events in history. In 1978 saw the unhinging of the pro-Western and far eastern defense areas of the Middle East. A few months ago, you'll recall that a military junta overthrew the government of Afghanistan. It was a leftist group, a leftist Muslim group, and they immediately went to Moscow for arms and for advisors and for a mutual defense treaty. And now there is the inevitable shift of power in Iran, and Washington must be wondering what this means for the security of our energy resource in Saudi Arabia, in Bahrain, in Kuwait, and the other Persian Gulf states. Certainly for a period of time, oil will continue to be pumped to the tankers and brought to the West. These countries, whoever governs them, require the monies that the West may bring. But whereas both the Shah and King Khalid and his advisors have been concerned with the economic security of the West, have recognized that something of their ability to survive in power rests with the ability of the West to remain economically strong, and have to a certain degree moderated the demands of the oil cartel for the gold of the West. Once the leftists achieve power, these demands will not be moderated. Oil will become again a weapon of international policy. For these men, many of whom are Marxists, would be delighted to see the unsettling of the economies of the West, their role in the precipitation of the demise of Western capitalism, and their ability to stay in power will no longer depend upon their ability to bring in weapons systems and advisors from the United States. There are other sources of weaponry, armament, and political support for them. A great deal has happened during this last year, a great deal that is unsettling. If I were to find words to describe 1978, one of the words certainly would be that it was changeful, that it was uncertain. At the end of the Second World War, the West tried to establish a system of world governance which would have some degree of permanence, stability, and security to it. Recognizing the emergence of the communist bloc, Secretaries Acheson and Dulles and others tried to build around the communist world a cordon sanitaire, a series of military defensive alliances, NATO, Greece, Turkey, Iran, CETO, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, which would contain communist intrusions into the West. We assumed the countries that were with us were stable and secure, and we assumed that the world could ultimately create a balance of power which would weigh one side against the other with neither being able to gain some advantage. What we were not prepared for was the changefulness within the domestic changefulness of the countries who presumably were on our side. Indeed, the very nature of modern life has been emergence, change, convulsion. There's hardly a country in which there hasn't been a major transference of power. And whereas we thought we could depend upon Turkey or upon Greece or upon the Southeast Asia countries or upon Iran, we find that the process of economic emergence has unsettled these governments. And there is a constant process of reform, of elbowing for power, of emergence of new classes, of revolution. And that increasingly in this process of change, there is uncertainty. Policies now need to be flexible. There is no way of assuming one can build a wall against a single enemy. One is not sure who is we and who is they. And so the world has to a large degree become a world of grays, like the day outside, when it's difficult to drive and it's dangerous to be abroad. And we're not quite sure what our policies should be or what the moral basis of our policies can be. When President Carter came to Washington, he brought with him a human rights crusade, a new concern for a moral basis for American foreign policy. And as we all know, when Andrew Young has tried to sound the human rights crusade throughout the world, his voice has often seemed incongruous, naive, given the realities of modern life. It's one thing to demand majority rule in Africa. It's another thing to find what a policy should be in order to guarantee or to make possible a peaceful transition of power, to guarantee at least the persons of those who are white, who have been the dominant minority. And even more so, it's difficult to understand where right lies when many of those who are demanding majority governance are revolutionaries committed to non-African ideologies and supported by Cuban and other non-African powers. Moral incoherence is the concomitant of a changeful and convulsive world. We've not known, for the most part, we nor any other powerful group in the world have not known how to react. As the Christian world watched the decimation of the Christian communities in Lebanon, they remained silent. As the United States watched the weakening of the Shah's power in Iran, we gave sympathy, but we couldn't send in the Marines. As the Chinese and the Soviet have watched war break out between their surrogates, their allies in Southeast Asia, Vietnam and Cambodia, they were unable to prevent the outbreak of this violence. It's uncertain how one is to react in this world where the future is always shocking and full of uncertainty. And where, in order to recognize reality, that is, the People's Republic of China, America finds that she must, or at least this administration believes that they must, renounce a affirmed, sealed, mutual defense treaty with the Republic of China, the Chinese who are now on Taiwan. It's a very difficult world for those of us who are committed to principle, and would want our government and other governments to be committed to those conditions, those principles of the human condition, which we believe to be right and to be just. Moral incoherence and uncertainty are certainly part and parcel of our world. You know, at the end of the Second World War, there was a simple world. It was we and they. And the Cold World continued that simplicity. There was our side, the free world as we called it, and their side, the communist world. And then the world became a little more complex as we began to see the emergence from colonialism of countries in Asia and Africa and Latin America and South America. We began to speak of the third world, as though there were now three great power blocks. But then that third world proved to have very little cohesion to it. Some nations found that they had great oil resource, great natural resource. Others remained embedded in incredible poverty. And in that world, there was change and convulsion and a grabbing for power. We saw countries that were simply lines in the map, but were really little more than tribal confederations with various tribes competing for power. We found that in most of that world, there was little ability to maintain stable government and really to develop a considered program for emergence. These countries, the more fortunate of the third world countries, began to wrestle with the problems of modernization, and they found themselves faced with great forces within the nation opposed to modernization, religious forces, tribal forces, the forces that of fear of change. Then as the third world began to break up, and as the second world and the first world began to compete for their loyalties, a fourth world emerged, the great world of China. And that world broke with the second world, that is, the communist world broke apart and began to compete with each other. And our world has become a multifaceted place, full of competition, full of contradiction, full of complexity. So much so that another characteristic of these times has been the inability of the world to accomplish anything. It's become increasingly difficult to accomplish any major change because there are simply so many balls in the air that have to be juggled, so many competing influences. Instead of moving towards a one world, instead of moving towards worldwide interdependence with all that that suggests, we've been moving towards ethnicism, towards the breaking down of national groups into cultural components, towards competing governments when there ought to be, one would think, cooperation for mutual advantage. In Africa, black nation struggles against black nation. In Asia, communist Southeast Asian nations struggle against communist Southeast Asian nations. Wherever we turn in our world, we find competition, convulsion, and confusion. And so one of the great realities of 1978 was really the inability to bring anything to conclusion. And symbolic of this were the year-long attempts to establish a mutual peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. 1978 began just 6 weeks after Sadat had been in Jerusalem. The January 1, 1978 issue of the Week in Review of the New York Times headlines "The Return to Reality." And the article on the front page of that Week in Review section describes the increasing difficulty that Egypt and Israel were having in working out practical arrangements that might bring the hopes of Jerusalem to effect. And during the long spring, the relations between Israel and Egypt became colder and colder. And there were attacks, and finally there was a provocation which led to the Israeli attack in the Lebanon. And the attempts for a peace treaty went into the deep freeze until they were taken out just before Camp David. And there we had the drama of the president of the greatest power in the world, a man beset by innumerable problems and innumerable challenges, spending 8 days of his time, full days, long days, at Camp David, doing nothing but trying to mediate between two small countries in the Middle East to establish a framework for a peace treaty. And out of Camp David, to most everyone's surprise, there emerged these two frameworks for peace, one having to do with the Sinai and the actual peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, the other a series of framework proposals for what might happen later in the West Bank and Gaza between Israel and the other so-called confrontation states. And you recall that famous Saturday night television from the East Oval Room of the White House in which the president spoke of the accomplishments of Camp David, and both Sadat and Mr. Begin spoke of their hopes that long before the 3 months deadline of December 17th, the actual terms of the peace arrangements would have been agreed on and signed. Well, December 17th has come, has gone. And there is no agreed-on peace treaty. There were too many balls in the air. Immediately after Camp David, the confrontation states organized a conference in Baghdad. And despite the bribes that the United States had offered to the Saudis earlier in the year, the sale to the Saudis of the most advanced supersonic jets in our armory. The Saudis went to Baghdad and joined in the agreements of Baghdad, which were largely the formulation of a northern coalition against Israel, which would be governed by Iraq and by Syria, the most radical of the states of the area, which would also organize an economic boycott of Egypt if she went ahead with the peace treaty with Israel. And the United States, eager to move larger peace concerns ahead, began to send our ambassadors to Hussein, to Khalid, throughout the Middle East, and they so frightened the Israelis by some of their statements, which went far beyond the protocols agreed on at Camp David, that the Israelis became gun-shy and began to demand, make other demands of the for protection from what America was saying. And then, under pressure from the Saudis, and because he recognized that America would pressure Israel, Sadat began to demand that certain agreed-on terms in the peace treaty be changed, and the present impasse emerged. A year has passed. There has been no war, but there is as yet no treaty. And this process of incompletion can be found again and again as we look through 1978. For 4 years, the United States and the Soviet Union have been negotiating about a SALT II treaty. This treaty was also to come to fruition at this time of the year, this year. But despite the most recent visit of Secretary Vance with the Soviet representatives in Europe last week, there is no SALT II treaty. Despite the attempts of the American government to speed one along by certain unilateral concessions, first on the B-1 bomber and then on the deployment, the manufacture and deployment of the so-called neutron bomb. Somehow it's too complex. Very last moment, one country or another brings in some other issue. And this week, too, there was to be the announcement of a new European currency. Countries of the European Economic Union had decided over the past 3 years that they ought to develop their own currency to tie the exchange rates of their countries together. And the first issue of this currency was to take place this tomorrow, on January 1 of 1979. But after 3 years of negotiations, just before the currency was announced, France declared that she would not go into this union unless the rest of the countries of Europe accepted a program to reduce and ultimately eliminate all farm subsidies, a political issue which had not been part of the major negotiations. The one issue which seemed to come to some resolution as far as the United States was concerned was the signing of a Panama Canal Treaty. In this sense, this was typical of the difficulty of bring anything to conclusion. Here was a treaty with a tiny nation, a treaty which was not to go into effect to the year 2000, a treaty which was guaranteed ultimately by the ability of the United States to intervene militarily in Panama to keep the canal open whenever we want to. Panama cannot oppose the United States militarily. A treaty which was obviously in the best interests of both countries because the present arrangement in Panama is an anomaly, an anachronism, a relic of a much earlier time. But despite all of this, it took 6 months of hard lobbying and negotiation for the treaty to be ratified by the United States Senate, and the ratification was assured only by a single vote. It's very difficult in this world of increased complexity to achieve anything. And if we are to look towards the future, this is perhaps the issue of greatest concern. I don't know if you remember a book that was written by the psychoanalyst Eric Fromm some 15 years ago. But he wrote a little book then called Escape from Freedom. And in this volume, he spoke of the man's limited ability to handle freedom, how we find it difficult to live in a world where we're told to make up our own minds, how we tend to escape from the difficulty of making a decision into ideology or into our dependence upon a father figure or a leader, how totalitarianism grows, fascism grows because of our own unwillingness inability to handle freedom. And what is it that frightens us in freedom? Complexity, indecision, moral incoherence. The fact that things are not black and white, that no decision is that clear and that certain. We want confirmation, we want reassurance, we turn to somebody else for that reassurance. If you look throughout the world, you find here and there and everywhere indication that the world is frightened by uncertainty and moral incoherence and an inability to bring issues to completion. One of the issues in Iran is the emergence of a community, religious community, afraid of modernization, afraid of women's rights, afraid of the industrial society, afraid of the breakup of the home, which is a byproduct of that society. And when we look in our own country, we see the reemergence here and throughout the West of the evangelical faith, the traditional faith, the cults, people who promise easy answers, simple answers, love, faith in the leader, faith in the old-time religion as panaceas for all the world's problems. And throughout the world, there's a great swing back from liberalism, from patient reform, from the willingness to apply one's mind to the problems at hand, knowing that the problem you manage to solve today will only create a new problem, the solution will only create a new problem that you must face tomorrow. For ideologies of the right, the left, for religions which promise certainty, guidance, for leaders who will take your problems on their shoulders and make everything right. We live in a world of increasing complexity, and we're showing in so many ways our unwillingness, our inability to handle complexity. In a sense, our president is this classic figure faced with this problem. He came to Washington because he appealed to that part of the electorate who believed that there were simple answers to the problems that Washington was making complex. He came to Washington as part of a simplicity crusade. We're going to get back to people. We're going to get back to human rights. We're going to do away with bureaucracy. We're going to do away with complexity in government. We're going to do it the old American simple way. And in the relationships to, let's say, to Israel and to Egypt, he's shown the impatience that we all feel. He doesn't like Mr. Begin. He does like Mr. Sadat. Now, besides the chemistry of personality, what doesn't he like about Mr. Begin, and what does he like about Mr. Sadat? He likes Mr. Sadat because Mr. Sadat talks in simplicities. He talks in broad concepts of peace and arrangements and treaties because Sadat has no land to lose. He can only gain oil, strategic advantage by whatever emerges. And what does Mr. Begin talk about? He talks about hills, and he talks about dollars, and he talks about defense lines, and he talks about every little issue implicit in the complexity which is negotiations. And the President of the United States wants to be through with it and on to other things. And Mr. Begin knows that the security of his nation depends upon going over every jot and tittle of the proposed treaty. And in many ways, we're like our president. We want simple answers to problems which are infinitely complex. And there are no such answers in our modern world. And we don't like it. A year ago, the president of the United States spent this season of the year traveling. He took a 7-day trip through 9 nations. He went to Poland, he went to Iran, he went to India, he went to Saudi Arabia, he went to Egypt, a quick stopover, and he went to France and to Belgium as part of a NATO treaty meeting. Many who wrote about that trip spoke of the president as escaping from the responsibilities of his complex office. He wanted to be a ceremonial president for a while. He wanted the pleasure of the bands and meeting heads of state and dealing with things that were not that complex. And then again, I found in the January 1, 1978 issue of the Week in Review in the New York Times, a column by Tom Wicker, which was entitled, Jimmy, Come Home. And the issue was this: we're glad you're enjoying yourself. but don't let it go to your head. The real problem is here. And the real problems are obdurate, complex. The economy. Inflation was then running at 6%. It's running today at over 8%. Unemployment, which was then at 6.9%. Urban decay. The problems of our educational system, the problems of our medical facilities and medical costs, the problems of urban blight, the problems of crime, the problems of American society. These are the ultimate responsibilities of any administration. And these are the problems that during his first year in office and for much of the second year, Mr. Carter really tried to avoid. Because they're complex. There are no easy solutions. We are not even sure that there are solutions. I'm not an economist, but I've been fascinated by how many articles I have read by men who are professional economists questioning the Keynesian basis of the theories which have governed our fiscal policy for the last 20 or 30 years. How much division of opinion there are as to basic economic principles among men who claim to be scientists, who claim that there is a right way, a clear way, to go about the business of economics, the business of finance. We find ourselves at the end of a year facing an uncertain economic future, the possibility, perhaps the probability of recession. We've been through a year where we've seen the value of the American currency deteriorate markedly against every other major currency in the so-called free world. We've seen the negative balance of trade increase to over $25 billion for the year. We've seen the difficulty of trying to open up other countries to our trade, even though our goods cost less because our money is worth less. The world's economic posture is a complex one. It's a mixture of free trade and of government subsidies and of tariffs. American businessmen who've tried to deal with the European economic market or in Japan have faced a whole series of bewildering difficulties in arranging for the acceptance of their goods and the sale of their goods. And I'm sure that those who deal with the United States must face, to a certain degree, a similar bewildering congeries of problems and of methods. It's very hard to know how one goes about solving the economic problems of our country or of the world. We decide, the president decides, that there's to be a 7% more or less voluntary lid on wages and prices. But he has built into the American economy a 15% increase in the minimum wage. He has built into the economic order a major increase in Social Security taxation. He has nothing to say really about the ability, about what oil will cost. And almost immediately after the announcement of this new policy, the OPEC nations meet and decide on an oil rise over twice the size of the 7% that limit that the president is trying to impose. Obviously, he's had to let interest rates rise precipitously, markedly. Obviously, he's had to face the problem of cutting the budget. And here, too, one sees the complexities of the issue. I'm sure that the president, above all things, would like to be able to cut the defense budget. It's the non-productive budget. But he's the president of the United States at a time when Russia has apparently found a way to cancel out the effect of our land-based Titan and Minuteman missile system. They have missiles now which can hone in on these permanently placed ICBMs. And so the president needs to increase, or believes he needs to increase, the defense budget by some 3%, which means that the $15 billion of cut in order to keep the budget at some $500 billion, that these budget cuts must come from the very things that people need most. They must come from aid to the center cities, health, education, welfare, housing, all the programs which are domestic in their concerns. It's not easy, and one can understand the impatience of those who are charged with power as they must deal with the complexities of power. And we can understand, but I hope we will overcome some of our own impatience. People have noted that in these United States, the American people have tended to turn off, to turn away from our political institutions, to become disillusioned. And many have explained this disillusionment by Watergate and by Koreagate and by Wayne Hayes and by Congressman Flood and the other examples of corruption in government. But I would suggest to you that the reasons are deeper. Politics inevitably has its percentage of corrupt people. But the real reason I would submit to you that Americans have become impatient with, indifferent to, distant from, and angry with their government lies in the complexity of government itself. We've become single-issue oriented. That is, we've become involved in one crusade or another because with that crusade we understand. We can make ourselves professional in it. You can understand what government agencies are involved, what committees are involved, what people concern, what are the issues. But to fit a particular single concern of ours into the whole congeries of issues which affect the American economy, the American way of life, or American foreign policy is beyond any of us. We have lived in a city, Cleveland, during a time when it became patently clear that no one in the government knew whether the city owed $12 million or $25 million or $52 million. Government has gotten beyond the ability even of those in charge of government, even if they're better auditors than some of the auditors in Cleveland, to understand what's involved, where the money's coming from. We used to understand if we raise taxes for this purpose, we'll have enough money for this service. But now taxes are taken from one pot and put into another. They come from the federal government, they come from the state, they come from the county, they come from the region, they come from the community, they come from property taxes, they come from real estate taxes, they come from sales taxes, they come from our income taxes. It's such a congeries, such a mishmash of authorities, of governing bodies, of issues, that we've lost our ability to understand how to go about managing our own destiny. It's no longer simple. And so we've taken our revenge on government with Proposition 13. And so we've gone about talking about our anger with our elected officials. And our elected officials have failed us at least in this, that none of them has successfully enunciated to us a philosophy, an overriding philosophy, an understanding of the complexities of the world in which we live and in which we will live out the rest of our lives. For our world will not be simplified. Urban life by its very nature is not simple. An interdependent world by its very nature is complex. But someone, somewhere must find the words, the philosophy, the liberating idea, which will help all of us understand that we live in a world of complexity and of uncertainty when it's going to be difficult to make the final arrangements, and that we're going to have, nevertheless, to live with freedom and not to run away from it, to live with complexity and not throw up our hands at it, and not to run to a leader or to an ideology, not to depend upon others, but ultimately to depend upon ourselves. It's not been an easy year. Colored gray. The future will not be easy. Colored gray. There is no evidence that mankind has the willingness or the ability to deal with complexity and uncertainty. But somehow we're going to have to find that ability. And as we do, we will discover that behind the headlines, behind the complexities, behind the uncertainties, some very positive things are occurring. The world is changing. I use the word emergence. The world, the peoples of the world are emerging. And adolescence is never easy. It's often violent and sometimes self-destructive. And obviously there has to be a readjustment of power, a readjustment of authority, a readjustment of the entire pattern of one's life during the periods of growth and of change. But whether we look at our country, where in the last 20 years, the other America, the dispossessed and the abused and those behind the racial curtain has been diminished by half. And whether we look at many of the countries of the world where new wealth is coming in, where new opportunities exist, we live in a world of change. We live in a world, therefore, of possibility. We live in a world of great challenge. All that I've been saying this morning can be reduced to this. Have we the guts, the intellectual toughness, to live through this period of change with our eyes clear, our mind realistic, our attitudes pragmatic, our social habits flexible, accepting the complexities of the life when they cannot be simplified, adopting a philosophy of patience when patience is required, and recognizing that the ideal of a static world, the old Platonic ideal, is an impossibility. The essence of life is change, even as the essence of an individual's life is growth. That we can grow if we're willing to make the effort. And the prayer that I would offer for this new year is already in our prayer book. We do not pray unto thee to make our lives easy, to give us happiness without alloy. Rather do we pray thee to aid us to be uncomplaining, unafraid. Teach us to face life with faith and courage. We may see the blessings hidden away even in its discords and struggles. Help us to wrest victory from the discipline of pain. Amen.